now. Before we get started, we'd like everyone to stand for grace.
Hello, my name is Grace Clovia Ture, and I have the admittedly inflated title of Queen of NMRC. And I just would like, to recite the Hacker's Prayer, please. Our avatar, who art in cyberspace, hallowed be thy name. Thy ciphers come, thy encryption's done, in the ether as it is in meat space. Give us our zero day, our daily root shells, and forgive us our intrusions, as we forgive those that attempt to intrude. And lead us not into a honeypot, and deliver us from Microsoft. For thine is the firewall, the IDS, and the eliteness, in an infinite while loop. Amen.
Dude, you totally swallowed. Okay, like I said, welcome to our panel. This is just a quick intro to give you guys our agenda and what we're going to talk about. I'm Helen Back, and this is pretty much all I'm going to do in this talk is give you these 30 seconds. We're going to start with Jay Random and Weasel. They're going to talk about the hack back. We're going to move on to Simple Nomad, who's got a couple cool tools to talk about and demo. Grace is going to read us a good hacktivist rant. Fuzzy Logic at the end here, he's got a couple zero days for you guys. Then we're going to move on to Inertia beside me here, and he's going to talk about NMRC OS. We'll go to some questions, and then Nomad's going to close. So without further ado, we'll go to Jay Random and Weasel.
Hey. So some of you may have heard about the HackFac, some of you haven't, so I'll just give you a rundown of history here. Simple Nomad down there, he started the NetWare HackFac back in many years ago. There wasn't really anything like a guide for hacking NetWare systems at the time. There was the Usenet groups, you know, like all 2600, the NetWare Usenet groups. So Nomad took the kind of collective wisdom of those Usenet groups and compiled it together in one document. Through successive revisions, he posted it to those news groups for although there haven't been any major revisions to it since about 1998, there's still some guy out there posting the version that we've got to those news groups. There was some significant criticism of the FAQ when it first came out as being simply a hacking manual, you know, a cookbook for newbies and script kiddies. But most of the feedback that has been received on it has been mostly from thankful system administrators who've read the FAQ, applied the knowledge, showed it to their management, showed them how important security really is. The hack fact is just about 50% of user-submitted comments. So I think it's a pretty good sign that it's been well-received. Not only have the Loft in its day and attrition pointed to the fact for beginners, but internally, Novell itself has recommended the fact to their customers. It wasn't long after the fact was released that people requested facts for other platforms. So Nomad started compiling the NT HackFac and the Web HackFac. The Novell FAQ itself went through about 7 major revisions, and the NT and Web FACs about 3 before the project was starting to combine all of it into what is currently the HackFac. One of the unrealized goals at the time when it was compiled was to have a single source for revisions, because at the time it was one HTML file, one series of plain text files, and it was just pretty difficult to keep track of all the changes between them. So the idea was that when everything got recombined, to have it encoded in SGML, you have a single source for changes. You can also have multiple output formats. It's okay.
Sorry.
You have HTML, plain text, RTF. So that brings us to where things are today. What we've done is we took Nomad's old non-validating HTML 3.2 code and
non-validating.
Used about five different WYSIWYG editors on it, I think. We've taken it and replaced it all with a validating XHTML and CSS, which gives us all the usual benefits of adhering to a standard, plus the added functionality that comes with using tools like XSLT for a nearly infinite number of output formats. Once we updated all the code, we began the laborious process of just plain old editing. It's been nearly 5 years since anyone has touched this project, which means a good portion of the fact's only value is as a historical curiosity. But pretty much everyone in the group has contributed in some way to bring the fact back into relevance. In addition, we've had our 5-year backlog of user-submitted questions, corrections, and suggestions. Sure, most of the email amounted to nothing more than, dude, I need to hack my girlfriend's Hotmail account. Will you do it for me? But we need a good laugh out now and then.
An appendix, yeah.
All right. So, yeah, we are reading email to fact@nmrc.org, even though these days it's mostly spam. But in the future, we expect to make the fact available in pretty much any format you want. You could have it in POD format for your POM. As well, we're very interested in having it translated for foreign languages. Spanish, French, you name it, we'd like to do it. So if you've got any questions that hasn't been answered, send them to us. If you come across questions you think are answered, asked too often without answers, send them to us, because that's where we're at. Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to cover several things here. For those of you that were at the my Black Hat talk, this is some of the stuff that I've been, a couple of tools I've been working on. These are more or less proof of, I would call them proof of concept tools, although they're actually completely usable as tools. What I've tried to do with this kind of little project I've created here is I wanted to have some tools that help enhance basically stealth types of communications, basically a form of anti-forensics that would happen on the system with using encrypt, being able to encrypt things and being able to wipe things securely after you've encrypted them. In addition to that, also doing some stuff with on the network, trying to come up with a way to do some stealth communications on the network. All of the stuff you're seeing here, as many of us know, is derivative of lots of other people's code. That's what most of us do. When I was looking for some of these tools, it was simply a matter of going out, Googling around and trying to find, does someone have a tool close to what it is that I'm trying to do? I found stuff close. I've altered it. I've added to it, tried to enhance it a little bit here and there, and come up with some halfway interesting things. First thing I want to talk about was encrypt. I actually probably didn't want to talk about encovert first, but I'll do them backwards. It doesn't matter. Encrypt, what it is, it does symmetric file encryption and decryption. For the encryption algorithms, I actually was looking at what was available. I decided that the AES process, that whole process to come up with the replacement for DES, looked pretty good because a lot of crypto people had taken a look at it, a lot of academia and whatnot. Basically, the best crypto people outside of the NSA had really had a good look at these algorithms. So one could bet that if you picked anything in the top three candidates for that, then that'd probably be a good thing. So I did go ahead and pick those top three candidates, which were Rheindahl, Serpent, and Twofish. For those bit-oriented people in the crowd, I think I'm doing 256, Rheindahl and Serpent, and the Twofish is 128. These were the versions that were, and I'm basically using the same implementation that was submitted to the AES process. I've essentially, more or less just grabbed their code and I'm using it because that was the source code that all of the other crypto people were looking at. So I was like, okay, well, that's probably halfway safe code right there. I've also included, I'm calling it secure coding features. Please, if you find flaws in this, and Jason, you can't point out again that you did a black hat, you know, the question you had about the SHA-1 thing, I will fix that, okay? So you can't bring it up, you write up a black hat, and you can't talk now. All right. Basically, what I'm trying to do with these secure coding features is I'm trying to eliminate the vulnerability, some of the vulnerabilities associated with encryption. Some of these vulnerabilities are, you know, if the passphrase is sitting there in memory, if it's been swapped to disk, that kind of thing. So I try to make sure, and a lot of other products do this, the PGP, GPG stuff. It does the same type of stuff. Where, you know, if you're running as root, it's going to actually, prevent swapping to disk. That's always a good thing. Also, as soon as you enter in your passphrase, you enter it in a couple of times. I'm using my own memset in case, because there was that problem with some of the compilers that actually wasn't doing a proper memset. We tried to zero something out. It wasn't zeroing it out. It happened during some compiler optimization. And so I've got my own memset in there, and what it does is once you get the passphrase in there twice, once in there, second to verify, the verify one, as soon as it's verified, wipe it from memory. Take the passphrase, feed that in, and take a SHA-1 of that. As soon as you're done, get that plain text thing out of memory, wipe it from memory. Then you take the SHA-1 and use that to generate my key that I'm going to be using for my encryption or decryption, and as soon as I'm done with the SHA-1, wipe it out of memory. Okay. Then go ahead and perform the encryption or decryption. And so I've tried to take into account this thing possibly running in hostile environments. I've included some anti-forensics in this. One of the problems that you have with doing this kind of thing is if you encrypt something, a lot of times you've got the plain text version sitting right there. You know what I mean? You've got that, you know, it's a text file or whatever. It's that .txt is still sitting there in plain text. You've encrypted it. Now you've got it safe. Maybe you want to check it to make sure it's okay. But the point is you've got that original file there that's still sitting there in plain text. Now, let's go ahead and try and erase it. Well, the thing is if you just do a simple RM of the file, it's still potentially recoverable through some type of forensics. So why not go ahead and try some type of file wiping to get rid of that thing off of there. So I've implemented two different wiping techniques in here. I think there's probably several people here familiar with Peter Gutman's paper from 1996, Secure Deletion of Magnetic Media, blah, blah, blah. I can't remember, it's a big, long title. Okay, a few people nodding their heads, great. Okay, it outlined, and this was basically for older drive technology, but among the paranoid, they probably would want to, the really paranoid would probably want to potentially use this. Essentially, what it did was it did four passes with random data. Oh, by the way, for all the random stuff used for the wipes, I'm using an implementation of Isaac instead of the normal pseudo-random number generator stuff that you normally get with your Unix system. Let's see, where was I? Oh, on the Peter Gutman's thing. Okay, so he does four passes with random data, basically over the top of where the file is, and then we do 27 passes of specific bit patterns that Gutman had outlined. Again, this was for much older drive technology, stuff that's around in 96, and then four more passes with random data. And that probably is... and actually, I got to talk with Peter in Australia. I was at a conference there, and we sat down, and I was showing him this. He found it funny that, you know, there's an option in there that says wipe Gutman, you know, in the, you know, that you can pass in there. He found that kind of humorous. But nonetheless, he thought it was complete overkill for modern drives. And it probably is, okay? It probably is overkill for that. So that's not too big of a deal. But for the real paranoid, if they want to go that route, they certainly can. Also, I implemented, this was the, I can't think of the official name of the paper. This is a military type thing. But basically, the implementation of DOD 5220.22-M, okay, which is what that is if you look through that particular DoD document, it has a section in it. I believe it's, let me see if I can remember. I think it's like Section 8, Subsection 306. It talks about sanitizing drives. Now, the original intention behind this, and I was fortunate enough to actually get to talk with the person who's now a former NSA person, but used to be with the NSA, who actually wrote this section of it and just said, you know, what was the idea behind this? Why did you have this? And what it was that the U.S. government had a lot of drives that is, if they had anything that was classified at all on those drives and they wanted to reuse that drive, instead of just wiping it and then they can reuse it for some other purpose, possibly even a non-classified scenario, it was not allowed. So what they did was come up with a standard where they could feel like it safely wipe the drive instead of having it physically destroyed. That way they can then reuse that for other purposes. They made the standard, which is still, I think, a little bit telling in itself. I'm actually getting a phone call during the presentation. That's absolutely amazing. Good God. Did one of you guys do that? Okay. Sorry, I just can't believe that. You tell people I'm going to be talking. It's probably one of you bastards out there, isn't it? Why don't you call my cell phone? Okay? Anyway, back to the military grade thing. So they want to be able to use these drives again. And this standard specifically applies to, doesn't apply to top secret, but it applies to just classified material. If you want to reuse a drive that has classified material, you do this particular type of wiping. Oh, good, they left a voicemail. Maybe it wasn't one of you. Okay. So what it is essentially you wipe with the character, you wipe with the inverse of that character. That's basically the complement, the bits flipped. And then you write with random data and actually go through and verify that pass. The other things that I try to do with this file wiping is to pick up the slack, the file slack. This is the stuff you get to the end of the file if you've been editing it and stuff. Different blocks will be used and everything, so just go ahead and wipe the entire block, okay? And then really shrink down the size of what that file is supposed to be before you wipe it. And then we go ahead and then delete it after it's been wiped like that. That hopefully prevents it from being recovered. Now, the reason why you would want a tool like this, okay, and I this was written, like I said, I used the libraries. Actually, they weren't even libraries. I used the C code that was submitted to the AES process. So they had something. I used their code, so I've implemented in here. So if you're compiling this on your own, you don't need any special crypto libraries. Okay, because the crypto is essentially all included in there. This comes in handy if you need to load this onto a machine that you don't have the crypto libraries onto. Maybe you don't actually own the box, okay? And you want to get this thing on there and you want to do some crypto stuff. A good example would be an ISP, an ISP shell server. You don't want that nosy admin that's running the thing that he won't load up any neat crypto libraries for you. He won't do any of that help for you. But as long as you got a C compiler, now you got something to keep him from looking around in your, in your files because he's poking around in there because he doesn't have anything to do. This is the type of thing you can use. Now I know some of you are thinking, okay, well you probably don't have root on the box, therefore you might be doing file swapping, and there are some other potential dangers. He could sit there and just snoop on your session and pick up your passphrase or whatnot. But I've tried to, as much as I can, try to minimize that potential risk for there. And that's one of the risk areas. Another risk area for this is it is possible that during this AES review of this code, there may have been stuff that had slipped by where there are flaws in either the code, or potentially later on someone actually may find some type of flaw in the crypto itself at some future date. Someone, you know, may crack some of this in some form or fashion. That's a potential risk area. There's a few others. I've included a README in with it that outlines some of this. By the way, if you're looking for Encrypt, it's a SourceForge project. I have not released the source and everything for this to SourceForge just yet because I wanted to make a few more tweaks for this. It was supposed to be on the conference CDs. I don't think it made it on there. Okay? So what I'm going to do as soon as we can get back to where there's a reliable network, nothing against the fine network we have here at DEF CON, okay? But as soon as we get to a reliable network and actually upload the code, we'll make it readily apparent. Yeah, as well as the HackFac, updates to the HackFac. Again, we were working on them while we were here, ready to upload, and we made the mistake of trying to do it from here. So once I have that done and made available to you, then that'll you'll have something really to play with. And if you all went to Black Hat, if any of you went to Black Hat, I believe it's on those CDs as well. The other thing you need to know about Encrypt is that I do have a Windows version of it, but half of these security features are not going to work on it. Okay? And that's a bit of a problem. Also, another thing on the it is. I mean, there's nothing you can really do about it. I mean, it's there's some of the stuff you just don't have access to be able to go there and do. One other potential risk area I forgot about. I wanted to mention for the wiping techniques. If this is being run on something that does like RAID or some type of journal file system, something that specifically tries to prevent you from deleting a file in a non-recoverable fashion. So it can actually, you know, potentially roll back or whatever. There is that potential that that's going to kind of make all the wiping, all our wipe foo we're doing here kind of more or less useless. But nonetheless, and that all that stuff applies even more on the Windows platform, believe it or not. I know you're surprised. Anyway, let's see. What I wanted to do, I was going to do kind of a demo of this. Let's hope that we don't have as much trouble. I need to test this anyway because the next part actually depends on it. Are we actually up on the screen? And that's perfectly clear to everyone, right? Everyone can read that, right? Yeah. If it's possible, if you could dim the lights a little bit. There's, you know, some kind of, you know, mood lighting. Get us in the mood. Basically, here's the, it would probably help to dim the lights up on this end. I shouldn't be insulting the goons. They're going to haul me out and throw me out of here, you know. Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Now our heads are in the way, so it doesn't matter anyway, does it? Okay. This basically gives you some of the options that we have there for it. We misspelled decrypt. How wonderful. Right there. See that? Yeah. Wonderful. I didn't spot that in the Black Hat talk. How amazing. All right. Well, and before someone asks about standard in and standard out, someone actually, I think last night while we were playing. Oh, you got it working? Okay. I needed to mention inertia has helped heavily on this particular program. I think what was out on the is out in the no, not Black Hat CD. SourceForge. Thank you. I think it's 063. It doesn't have quite as many of these features in there. And I can go ahead and do some of this. I mean, this is kind of boring. Let me see what I got in here. But I'll do it anyway because that's, you know, just the kind of guy I am. The main one I wanted to show you is just with the wiping because that's kind of. I'm looking at the help screen because. Yeah. Well, it'll just. Look, I did this at Black Hat, and I used the wrong option, and all it did, instead of like doing the encryption of the file, it just wiped the files. Okay, so it wasn't a good move. So I'll do it a couple of times here, all right, and then I'll do it once, then I'll clear the screen, and then do it again. Boy, this must be very, very exciting for for all of you to watch your movie. Thank you. Thank you. I'm not sure if you really meant that. I think you were mocking me. Thank you. Thank you. Rough crowd. Let's see if we do the M. This, in theory, should work. Equal option Z, that's not going to help me. Let me just go ahead and just do the encryption here. Yeah, I know. You would not believe.
Took them on, and we're trying to teach them how to use computers. So we're working on it.
Okay. Let me go ahead. I'm going to wipe a file here with the dash V on. That'll show you more what this is. Shut up. I think I wiped the files again. No, here we go. All right. I want to use that one again. What was that? No, wait, never mind. I don't want to know. Yeah. Hey, you try getting up here in this heat in front of this mean crowd. God damn it. All right. I'll just wipe a file just to show that. We'll do the Gutman. It'll take longer. Use more time. Okay. The encryption's fairly easy. You just put in your password twice. In this particular one, we're doing the 35 passes. I mean, at that point, you cannot recover the file. I've actually done this and tried the Coroner's Toolkit to try to recover these files once they've been wiped, and it will not recover them. Okay? On the Windows stuff, it won't recover them either. Okay? The problem is on the Windows side, I can't get the file slack stuff to work, so if anyone wants to look at the source and help me out, that would be grand. All right. Are we working? Okay, great. All right, nCovert. I'm not sure why. There's already been some press out on this from when I talked about it at Black Hat. I'm actually not sure exactly why, because personally I like the Encrypt one better. And by the way, the nCovert one's going to work better up here because I actually did, for the person talking about shell scripts, I actually did try that. That's what I was working on, making the beeps during earlier. What this is a stealth communications tool. What I'm doing is I'm using the initial sequence number to move data from one computer to another. All right? Now, I don't have any fancy diagrams, and I probably should have included them, but you all seem like a fairly bright audience. Certainly the most attractive audience I think I've ever seen in my life. But there you go. But nonetheless, I mean, I think you can kind of follow along with what I'm saying here. What nCovert does is it allows you to do an anonymous send. This is based off of Chris Rowland's covert TCP. It didn't have near is one of these things. It didn't have nearly as many features as I wanted to, so I've added some in here to try to do what I wanted it to do. The thing that it does is you have, let's say, computer A and computer B. I'll demonstrate this in a second. It'll be a little bit more clear. We have computer A and computer B. I'm going to transmit data from computer A to computer B. Now, what I can do is, and I don't have quite, believe it or not, we don't have quite enough equipment up here to do what I was wanting to do, but nonetheless, what you can do is I can send from computer A, I use the source address, I forge it with computer B's address, and then I send it to, say, yahoo.com or whatever, just someplace, port 80, something that I know is going to be open. Something that computer A is probably going to be able to get to. That return packet is going to come back with my ISN, incremented by one, I believe, and then back over to computer B, where it gets picked up, and that's how I move data from one side to the other. You kind of follow me here? Where I'm doing the bounce? Okay. Okay, good. Yeah, most people are not. That's the thing. I did a technical talk a few years ago at DEF CON, and most of you glazed over. You guys are a much smarter audience than that group then, let me tell you. And to communicate what file size you're working with, because it does get chopped off, otherwise you may have some extra data at the end, I use the IP ID in the first packet as it goes over. Okay, so that way I can, and I'll show you this here in a second. Where are we at in this thing? Oh, there's the live demo of Vancouver. All right, let me go over here, and I got to switch back. Jesus Christ. Yeah, I should have done VMware. Thank you. Then I would have needed a hub, would I? Clear the screens. All right, so on this end, what I'm doing, and yeah, you can halfway read that. I put it in verbose mode so you can actually see what's going on. This, I'm using a destination address is the .7 address. The source address is .1. And I'm going to save the file that I get. I'm going to save it as test file 2.txt. And we're in the temp2 directory over here. We're in the temp directory. I'm going to send it. And basically, I'm forging it. I'm on the same machine, but you're going to get the idea because it does get out onto the actual interface. I'm going to use the source address of this machine over here. I'm going to forge it, set the destination for .7, and the file I'm sending is test file .txt, which is in this directory. So I start this one off first, and then I start this one off, and it starts sending the data. It's coming across, as you can see, that's obviously plain text, and it's receiving it over here. And you see here's where it sent the data and everything, got the file size in there. This comes up in the verbose mode, so you can see what's going on. And then it receives it over here, and essentially what you have is, if I cat out the test file, a very simple file, and then I cat it out here. And this, so the file is moved across there. Now the advantages you have to this, like I said, if you plan this out properly, you can bounce traffic off of one computer to another. It does automatically, if you're bouncing, I didn't do the bounce thing here, but if you're bouncing it off of a computer, it does increment the ISN, and this thing automatically decrements it so that all the numbers line up. Obviously, the file that I was sending there, you know, was very short, and you can see the plain text. I put it in there on purpose so you can see what's getting fed into each packet and everything. You would want to encrypt the data. That was kind of why I should have done encovert first and then said, okay, now here's how you do your encryption before you do this. He said he's got standard in and out working. That'll be great because then we can just feed standard out straight into encovert, which now I'm going to have to add standard into, and then you can just immediately send out onto the internet. Now, some of you are probably already saying, well, hey, wait a minute, there's other things you could probably do with this. And yes, there are other things you can do with this. There are other fields that are available in this. There are other fields that I could use for other purposes in this. You could potentially use all kinds of mechanisms such as various crypto type things. I can throw in like maybe a one-time password, maybe actually send my password in a one-time pad type of way. Use OPI, for example, to go ahead and send something across. The other end knows, goes ahead and picks it up and decrypts it automatically. So there's a lot of possibilities with this. Also, since when I'm doing the receiving, I'm sniffing. Okay? So even though I sent it to .7, this box could have been .6 because it was sniffing. Now that becomes interesting because if I'm bouncing it off of a server, let's say yahoo.com, as long as I'm in a spot where I can sniff the return packet, it doesn't matter where I'm at, as long as I'm in the path of where that thing's going to. So maybe I need to be on the same class C, like say a cable modem or something along those lines. Or let's see, hold on just a second. Or if it's a, let's say I'm upstream of this device somehow, I'm upstream at an ISP, for example, I can go ahead and pull it off that way. Do you have a long question? We're going to hold questions to the end, but I'll go ahead and take it.
Can you bounce on multiple IPs? Specify multiple IPs to bounce?
Okay, you're already getting into the realm of possibility that I think is really cool. He's talking about bouncing off of multiple IPs. The first thing I need to do, because right now the reliability of this is as reliable as UDP, okay? That's essentially how reliable it is. Now, you could do some other things with it, but you'd have to be able to keep track of the packets. Specifically, say, okay, well, I received this packet in, I received this other one in from this other odd source address. You need some way of being able to identify not only did I get all my packets, but now place them in the right order. okay? That's not impossible. There's plenty of little bits and pieces in here that could be played with to do that. It's not outside the realm of possibility. If you took this to the umpteenth degree, you could actually expand this to the point where you're actually running an IP stack inside IP, so to speak. It wouldn't be very sophisticated because you'd be running out of room, but it actually could be done. Question? The question was if you could pick your own crypto. Are you talking about the encrypt or the encovert? Encrypt, the only reason I don't have Blowfish in there is because I haven't added it in. That's it. Feel free. It's a wonderful world. You want to do it and send me patches. Great. You know. Basically, that's it in a nutshell. That's how this particular thing works. And if you got more questions on it, we're going to do some QA at the end. By the way, this is a double session. In case you didn't know, sorry if you guys have to pee. You know. But yeah, if you've got some, yeah, there's plenty of cups in the back. Okay, next up, Grace, who kindly read the hacker prayer to us, is going to read a hacktivist type of rant from Sheeta. Sheeta could not be with us. She was scheduled to be here. She is in Ireland and couldn't make it over due to part financial and part had work to do. So she's being kept busy, which is a good thing. But anyway, here's Grace to read Sheeta's thing here.
Thank you. She entitled this paper, Don't Be a Tool. Benjamin Franklin said, on founding the U.S. Free Public Library System, to pour forth benefits for the common good is divine. Truth and knowledge are fundamental principles for hackers. Hackers abhor lies, FUD, and academic knowledge restricted to a privileged few. Nothing irritates a hacker more than reading a technical analysis without supporting data. Information should be free, available for all to draw their own conclusions. When told there are only two ways to do something, hackers figure out a third based on their own interpretation of available data. This creative, innovative mindset is not popular with the mainstream, unless they think they can profit from it. We all know there are a plethora of definitions for the term hacker. Old school, black hat, white hat, gray hat. Hell, we've got more hats than Dr. Seuss. How can you define a term for a group that will argue any definition, knowing such definitions to be limiting? Mainstream society usually defines hackers as destructive kids who deface websites or steal credit cards, criminals. Mainstream security companies and government may soon have a new definition, tools. Sadly, many hackers are unwitting tools, blindly following the proddings of the security industry. Prime example was the recent Defacers Challenge, a supposed competition to name the top defacing group. The top prize, 500 meg of web hosting and a free domain name. Oh yes, and bragging rights to being known as the top defacer. Who benefited from this challenge? The hackers? Any hacker who can't figure out how to get a paltry 500 meg of storage and a domain name should just give it up right now. As Deep Throat advised Bob Woodward during Watergate, follow the money. ISS, a company that sells security products and services, led the pack by inflating the importance of the Defacer's challenge, prompting many others in the technology field to desperately seize the opportunity to hype products and services. The hype got to the point that even those who knew this to be of little consequence were forced to address the so-called threat. Security marketing people just love when hackers reinforce the stereotypical image that they are a threat to society. This helps sell articles, services, and products to a fearful public. People tend to fear that they don't what they don't understand, and this fear is often manipulated to control the masses. A few decades ago, it was feared a few supercomputers would rule the world, eliminating free choice. This was demonstrated in science fiction movies like Demon Seed and Colossus: The Forbin Project. Even the classic 2001 A Space Odyssey portrayed the dangers of having computers in control. Man's greatest invention could be man's greatest mistake. Computers are now as common as the household TV. People feel more reassured that they have achieved some control over computers. After all, the term personal computer connotes personal control. Yet now people are conditioned to fear losing control, if they ever had it, to nefarious hackers. The boogeyman has shifted from domination by computers to domination of computers by hackers. Who is really threatened by hackers? Assuming a hacker is one who desires the free flow of information, it isn't hard to recognize who would feel threatened by this. Those who want to control the masses, such as government and big business. Although the U.S. was founded on the principles of freedom, it is rapidly regressing to a repressive government supporting business monopolies. The powers that be would have one believe that hackers are a threat to the common good. They'll steal your credit card. They'll steal your identity, your very soul. What are they really afraid of? That hackers might free people from the thumb of monopolies like the RIA and MPAA? Hackers represent freedom, and people now are more than ever willing to relinquish freedom for the false sense of security they are told repressive legislation such as the U.S. Patriot Act or the DMCA will bring. People, especially in the United States, now seem to be experiencing doubts about the necessity of information and the importance of freedom. They are being conditioned to fear technology, innovation that isn't controlled by a sanctioned source. The RIA and MPAA is rapidly losing the fight to control file sharing and is now resorting, with the cooperation of the U.S. government, to instill fear by threatening freedom in the form of lawsuits. Instead of holding on to an archaic, though highly profitable, distribution mechanism, they should move with the times and develop technologies more suited to today's culture. People don't want to be forced to buy an entire CD of music when they only like two songs, and there is no reason why they should be forced to. Technology hasn't eliminated free choice. On the contrary, it has enabled wider choices. Where once competition was limited to local merchants and their distribution methods, vendors now have to compete with a worldwide market. Don't like the price your local car dealer wants for a car? Just search on the internet to find it cheaper and with the options you want. Those who seek to control society are now desperately trying to control the internet. Technology is being classified as good or bad, the latter including anything that is bad for government and businesses. As with any tool, technology itself is ethically neutral. Its value to society as a whole depends on how it's used. Those in the security field are accustomed to viewing firewalls and intrusion detection systems as good. They keep the bad guys out. Yet in countries with repressive regimes, such as China, They are used to control information so people only hear what the government deems appropriate. Technology has simply permitted us to accelerate what we were already doing as a whole, good, bad, or indifferent. Yes, bad guys will use technology to facilitate their actions. They probably use telephones as well, yet we understand the benefits of telephones to society outweigh the threat to society. Hackers need to beware of confirming the stereotype of being a threat to the common good. Fight the real enemy, the monopolies dictating how and in what format we can receive music and movies. The governments that want to censor our information input, hackers can help by developing technology that will make it increasingly futile for control methods to be effective. If you don't have the technical ability to develop such technology, you can still help by supporting those who do. Free technology resources are rapidly disappearing as their operators surrender to the desire to actually make a living. If you can't financially support the people developing free technology, you can write your legislators, and tell them how you feel about repressive legislation. In closing, consider this quote from Benton G. Cerf. The internet is one of the most powerful agents of freedom. It exposes truth to those who wish to see and hear it. It is no wonder that some governments and organizations fear the internet and its ability to make the truth known. If you can't be a part of the solution, don't be a part of the problem. Don't be a tool. And on behalf of Sheeta, I thank you. And next up is Fuzzy Logic. He'll discuss Zero Day.
Everybody hear me? Okay, excellent. Wasn't sure if it was working. Before I discuss some of the Zero Day that we've been working on, some recent vulnerabilities, I just wanted to put a little background to the story. This presentation is actually going to be about an experiment in responsible full disclosure. Don't know if anybody saw Silvio's talk, but he talked a little bit today about his experiences with reporting vulnerabilities in kernels to some leaders in the open source community and how quickly they responded and how proactive they were. Well, this presentation is actually going to be in pretty stark contrast to what Silvio talked about, and we're going to be discussing our experiences with the closed source community. There's been talk in recent time about establishing some generally accepted principles of responsible disclosure, perhaps compiling into a standard that everybody should abide by, security researchers and vendors alike. This stuff is essentially aimed at curbing sort of the cowboy approach to disclosure. Find a bug, code an exploit, release it to your closest friends for them to hack websites, and hopefully force the vendors into actually taking a look at the problem and fixing it. Some stated that this was necessary maybe 5-10 years ago, but nowadays vendors are much more responsible, much more aware of the problems of, you know, if somebody finds a problem in their code, it affects more than just their bottom line, it affects their client's bottom line, and really it's not really necessary anymore for exploits to be released publicly. We followed a certain process in doing this. Some of the vulnerabilities that we discovered, before I get into that, just wanted to talk about how we went about contacting these vendors. The first thing we did is got their first contact list. Most vendors are part of this incident response organization and have their security contacts listed. So we first initially emailed them. We waited for about 2 weeks. If we didn't receive a response in 2 weeks, we took a second step of telephoning their tech support and opening up a trouble ticket. Then we waited another week, If we didn't hear back from the vendor on what the status of our report was, then we actually contacted CERT, see how they do with it. So that's the process followed. Just some brief problems that we encountered. Number one, there was the initial response to the reports were quite long, or in some cases even non-existent for each of the steps that we followed. Second thing is none of the vendors provided daily or weekly updates as to, you know, what they were doing to fix the problem. I actually had to hound them on a daily basis for a period of time. If patches were released, I sure as hell wasn't notified of them. So I guess we'll get into some of the vulnerabilities. These three vulnerabilities were actually reported about a year and 3 months ago, 3 to 5 months ago. And after basically a brief email exchange to explain what the technical issue was, I sort of left it up to the vendor to patch and waited a really long time. And I monitored some of the patch notices that would come out, see if my vulnerability was listed there anywhere or they described it. Basically, none of that happened. Three vulnerabilities really quickly. One is in the VXPrint utility, which is part of the Veritas net backup. I know there was a company called Secure iTeam that found a few problems with this utility. Didn't find anybody reporting the -E option on VXPrint. Basically, it's a simple stack overflow, 256 bytes to the -E option. EIP is overwritten, so it's a fairly easy exploit. Wanted to get that out there. So there's number one. Number two is actually part of OpenView's network topology daemon. Runs on port 888, and it actually sets up a really, really big buffer for input once you connect. You're supposed to negotiate a session with it. Instead, if you just dump, if you fill up a 10K buffer, it'll overflow and overwrite EIP, and away you go, having fun. So just want to get that. And the last one was a company called NetApp. They have a little fireless system. Well, their RSH daemon, username, 500 bytes. You can have some fun on there. That's a description of what we found. Pretty simple, basic flaws. What happened since then? Haven't heard any updates from any of the vendors. There was no patch notification that said, you know, there's an overflow in the RSH daemon, you know, NetApp, let's tell our clients and stuff. None of that happened. I read the errata that came out of all the patch updates that HP sent out and NetApp and Veritas, and none of them actually mentioned any of these specific vulnerabilities. I tested the NetApp vulnerability with the latest version of the filers last week. It's still vulnerable. I checked a Solaris 8 system a few months ago. This was going back about 2 months ago. Latest version of Tivoli, which actually incorporates some components of the OpenView thing, with the latest Solaris patches, still vulnerable. The VXPrint, not really sure, but I did some searching on the net and couldn't find anybody reporting anything about the -E option, so I'm going to assume that it's not fixed. Some of the basic reasons that I think that this occurs is, number one, there's no definite time between the tech support departments, the call centers that get the calls, and the security group. So when we had three lines of reporting, they didn't respond to the email. Sure as hell didn't respond to the trouble ticket either, because I guess the help desk folks probably didn't even know that they had to send it to the security department to take a look at. That's my best guess. There should be an escalation procedure, basically, that says if somebody reports a security vulnerability to the help desk, it gets escalated to the appropriate people. Another vulnerability, which we'll release in a little while, is actually denial of service condition in a Cisco IDS products. In talking with the product line vendor for Cisco on this, I actually got an email from him that said to the effect that I asked him about, you know, what the process is for reviewing vulnerabilities and reviewing code. basically said that we have some kind of process, but it's not that. And basically what he meant that is that they do functional design testing, but they don't actually have a team in-house that reviews code from a security perspective. And this is a problem everywhere. It's not just Cisco. It's HP. It's IBM. That's why we see some of the basic stack-based overflows that we've known about for 20 years still integrated in products. In the case of NetApp, a fairly new company, still hasn't quite learned. Another problem that I think results in this is that the software development process is run more from the marketing departments, push things out quickly, worry about security and everything else later. It's still a mentality that exists. Basically, peer review doesn't also happen in some of these organizations. I think people should be reviewing their own code within an organization, just like people do in the open source model, but in the closed source community, it doesn't happen. So all of these stuff compiled together creates a big problem. So here's phase two in our experiment. Get the zero day out there, and let's see some folks code up some exploits and hope and pray that the vendors fix it. That's it. Next is going to be Inertia, who's going to talk about our NMRC OS. Thanks.
All right. Can everyone hear me? I guess so. My name is Inertia, and I'm the principal developer for NMRC OS. Obviously, something as complicated as an entire distribution you cannot do yourself. Everybody helped out. We designed NMRC OS for ourselves because none of the other distributions of Linux out there really did what we were looking for. We thought about and regarding those other distributions, we thought about, you know, well, why not just you know, send patches in or help them out, you know. Well, that's great, but sometimes a lot of stuff that we want to do may not, you know, jive with the goals that they want. So this allows us the control that we require over everything that goes in the distribution, how it works. So that's why we decided to come out with our own distribution. One of the things that we focus on in this that perhaps some others may not is that we focus on not only the security for the owner of the box, but also the security and privacy of every individual user. We like to support cryptographic file systems. Every user can have everything encrypted. You know, we have Encrypt on there. We're really trying to go after helping the users of the systems be as private and anonymous as they wish to be. Initially, we started off, Nomad was going to do a modified Slackware install. And, you know, it kind of floundered around. We never really had the resources and, you know, never really did a lot. I had some free time, so I contacted him about starting it up again, and he was all for it. So what we did was I know everyone's probably wondering, is it RPM or Deb? It's Debian-based. Everyone else does RPMs. We figured, what the fuck, we'll do Debs, right? So, I looked into it a little bit, and we found out that Debian seemed to have the infrastructure in place to support a development model where we could not necessarily spend 100% of our time, you know, fixing shit. You know, we could go back and forth. You know, they have the package tracking systems, the bug tracking. You know, everything's in place there, and most importantly, their documentation is extremely up to date. So it made it really easy for us to go in and start tweaking stuff and adding stuff and things like that. A good example of, you know, the difference of opinion between why we started our own distribution instead of just, say, joining the Debian team, would be that there were several mailing lists with regarding something as simple, mailing lists, several mailing threads regarding something as simple as Bash clearing the screen on a logout. The end result, the end decision in the Debian team was that clearing the screen upon logout was not appropriate. Obviously, you know, security through obscurity never works. However, it does help, you know, to when your screen clears, you know, you don't have to worry about someone walking by, you know, shoulder surfing whatever you're doing last time. And again, you know, the idea for this is to help the users. Some of the users may be clueless and not know. So this, you know, something as simple as clearing the screen whenever you log out, that's something that we want to do. And if you extrapolate that, take that further, that's why we have our own distribution. We're looking forward to it. We also tweaked the kernel heavily. It's got several kernel mods, the OpenWall kernel patch, the HapLinux patch. Trusted Path is enforced. We got random IP IDs. I think the last test we did with Nmap says it doesn't know what the fuck it is, right?
It says it knows it's possibly a Linux system.
Okay, all right. So we're trying to get that whole, you know, stealth thing working where Nmap doesn't know what's going on. Let's see here. We also include, some of you might be wondering, you know, we included sendmail 8.12.9. We did that because Nomad insisted on it. Currently, is anyone familiar with Debian? Yes, no, maybe? Okay, just a couple of them. Well, they have three mini distributions within their distribution, stable, testing, and unstable. Currently, sendmail 8.12.9 is in unstable. So why the fuck would we choose unstable software and put it in our distribution, right? Well, it has to do with some security things in there, and again, it, you know, came down from the mountain on a tablet from Nomad, so, you know, that's why we did it. The other thing that's going on, I believe that we're the only distribution right now that currently auto-runs Bastille upon install. We have a couple different setups. It'll auto-run Bastille. It'll set up a firewall. It will allow you to configure the firewall, and whenever you say you install Apache, it'll automatically open port 80 and port 443, you know, for you. Those are the kind of things we're adding to this. Pardon me. It installs and boots up in a lockdown state. We've run Nmap against it. Thank you. We've run Nmap against it repeatedly during the install process and made sure that all the ports are locked out as soon as possible. We haven't, if you're familiar with the Debian install, it does a two-stage install. The first part, we haven't really tweaked anything because all it does is really, you know, partition your hard drive and, you know, things like that. Then it reboots into the second stage where you, you know, set things up, add more packages and all that crap. That's what we kind of focused on. Why would we want to write our own installer when Debian's getting ready to release their other one sooner or later, hopefully? Let's see. We got Encrypt on there. Encovert is not on there.
Sorry.
We don't think we got it done in time. But there are instructions when you install it. We have a dedicated machine, nmrcos.nmrc.org, that has an app repository that you can update to. Please try to install from the CD to prevent us from running out of bandwidth. Anyway, I'm going to be talking more about this tomorrow at 2, if you want to come and make fun of me, that's great. And that's all I have.
Okay, we're going to take some questions and things. One caveat, though, if you're a reporter, don't bother. what we're actually after the talk, we'll be up in the press room for a while. So reporters, please wait till then. Let everyone else ask their questions. Over there.
What was the question?
We don't have one yet, but that's a good idea. The question was, can we set up a BitTorrent tracker? Yeah, we don't have one yet, but that's a good idea. We'll try to get that up and running for people.
Over there.
Let me take that one. I was responsible for the kernel stuff. Why did we use OpenWall as opposed to the GRC stuff? Originally, when I first started this whole thing, 2.2 was the latest kernel. That's how long I've been working on this stupid thing, all right? At least from my perspective, from the kernel. Also, I spent a whole lot of time doing a very simple but a very effective trusted path implementation. And I didn't want to have to go back and simply not use it. Isn't that kind of lame, I guess? But nonetheless, I mean, I have a lot of respect for what the OpenWall people have done, and it's kind of a, you know, to support them, I guess. But, you know, the OpenWall and the Hap Linux, it had a lot of stuff in there that specifically we needed. There's a lot of stuff in the GRC. Is it GRC? Is that correct? Am I saying it right? GR Security. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in the GR Security patch. That's a lot more complex to set up, and until we can get a handle on a way to automate that and come up in a more secure fashion, we're not going to use it. But odds are very strong we're going to be moving to that. I mean, as this thing kind of takes off, we'll be moving to that when we go to a 2.4 kernel. By the way, you can ask questions on any of the any of the topics.
Someone over there is waiting on.
That's on the to-do list. Again, it was one of those things where we tried to make it to where it would be just, you know, painless for people.
The question there was that she's wondering if we're doing a cryptographic file system now or if it's coming. There's one over here.
Repeat the question. Sorry, I was
going to have to run and get something over here out of my bag for the remainder of the talk. So could you repeat the question? In covert through a stateful firewall. That could be interesting. You could possibly rig up something to trigger it to actually work. But you'd have to send in other packets in there. It really is intended in its infancy here to actually... work in a fairly open type environment. You're coming in from an ISP that allows, or from work or whatever, that allows outbound port 80, for example, or something along those lines. That's how it was originally intended.
One over there.
Control the timing of outbound packets? No, that's a good idea, though. And it probably should be random, because if you had a bunch of packets that came out spaced out in 1 second intervals, that would probably look kind of obvious. So, that's actually one of the things that's been suggested, and it is on my to-do list. You have to bear in mind, within covert, one of the last, it was like 5 p.m. before I left, I was on the day before I left, I found like a major flaw in it, okay? And so I spent a lot of time yelling and cussing and screaming, just to get the thing done in time to get here. So, you know, just... You know, be thankful I got it done and just stayed us in, I guess.
Just so you guys know, I know some of you guys have taken off because you think we're done. We're not. There's going to be a Simple Nomad rant after we're done with the questions right here in the front.
Well, we've got to repeat the question for me. What do the packets look like on that end? Typically, what happened? The question was, what does it look like when you're bouncing packets from point A to point B? What does it look like on that intermediate server? Let's say you're bouncing it off of Yahoo or whatever. It looks like you're opening up a SYN
and immediately closing it. Because what happens is when you send the SYN and the SYN act goes to B with the data in it, the OS on B sends a reset. Typically, you don't want that, you know, we might make sure you have closed ports or whatever. It'll just basically, when you according to the RFC, if you receive a SYN act, an unsolicited SYN act, you're supposed to respond with the reset, and that's what it does. So it does close the port on there. Now, so that means that on that intermediate system, it's going to receive a lot of open and closes and stuff like that on there. If you're doing any type of, if you're bouncing off of some interesting Unix system, they're probably logging all that stuff. So you bounce it off of a printer. You bounce it off of a Windows machine, you know?
We had a question right here.
Thinking behind that, it was an experiment. Let's see if, given a long amount of time, what they do with it.
Question is about the exploits for the tape recording.
Oh, sorry.
Also, the other thing on that exploit stuff, this stuff has started to appear outside of our realm. We started hearing about it from outside of NMRC, so we know that basically some of the information has got out. I don't know if it got leaked because one of our boxes got popped. It's possible. Hellenbach rooted me actually as late as last night, I believe, or perhaps earlier today. Freaking bastard. This afternoon? Great. Asshole never cleans up after himself. I gotta go in there and clean up all his shit.
I actually don't know how, because I'm just writing a script that someone else gave me, so.
All right, he admitted it in front of a DEF CON crowd. He's a script kiddie.
Question over here?
No, the question was if we implemented crypto on the sequence numbers. No, it just basically, what we're hoping is that on the initial sequence numbers, that the fact that you've encrypted the data beforehand makes it look random. That is actually a problem, because normally initial sequence numbers will tend to increment randomly, and this necessarily won't look like increments.
Okay, the question was, can Inertia explain a little more about the user segmentation and some of the features around that?
Well, I'd be glad to. I'm not sure if I'd have much to talk about tomorrow. is that okay? Okay, thanks.
we got one right here.
Yes, actually, I spoke with some of the guys from the HoneyNet project at Black Hat, and we were talking about them using our NMRC OS as a base for their bootable HoneyNet CD. So, yeah, that's definitely a project we're interested in moving forward with.
All right, another one over there. I think probably contacting CERT is probably what got everything out there, because I think that's pretty much a public mailing list now, isn't it?
Well, I contacted CERT. One person responded back and gave me a tracking number. Didn't hear from them for a few weeks. Called back, said, what's the update? Somebody else called, emailed me, rather, and gave me another tracking number. And nothing happened, and I said, the hell with CERT.
If that's it for questions for now, we're going to let Mr. Nomad here take over.
Okay. Have you noticed the change? Do you remember where you were when you first felt the change? I'm talking about the change in the security community
especially the underground community. Less trust, more control, and less truth. And I'm not talking about society since 9/11, although most certainly looking at things like USA Patriots and DSEA, one can certainly see less trust, more control, and less truth. I'm talking about the underground closing ranks, the emergence of Richard Thieme's third-generation hackers. The holy trinity of hackers, truth, control, and trust. Typically, the purest form of knowledge, the facts, are what hackers refer to as truth. A wisp of falsehood or lie will cause a hacker to bristle. With the nature of hacking being to learn the true nature of something, the truth is an important commodity. Trusting a truth, an important item on the hacker checklist. Can a truth be trusted as really being true? Crawling through the ether, keeping enemies as friends, encountering the unknown, a hacker needs to know not only who to trust, but what. And it is never a glass that is half empty or half full. It is a swirling and ever-changing fishbowl filled with truths and lies, all swimming together and influencing each other. Finding the truth needle in a haystack of disinformation, the marching orders of the new millennium hacker. Hackers need to be able to not only understand the control mechanisms that surround a truth and the nature of those controls, but to understand the responsibility that comes with exercising control over a truth. Also knowing when and how you're being controlled and manipulated, be it by pervasive means or by the fact that you are aware your actions are being monitored. Having your actions monitored can influence your behavior substantially. Between TLA-driven carnivore-styled systems to enemy hackers with DSNF to nosy ISP admins, the tilting game board has not just shifted the controls, but the mere threat of controls has changed hacker methods drastically and permanently. There are hackers, white hat type of hackers, that have removed code from their web pages simply because of the threats posed by such things as DMCA. Talk about Sun Tzu tactics. Many coders remove their work from the net without any laws being used against them. That is a serious control mechanism right there. The new millennium hacker has seen this landscape of unknown enemies and unknown numbers, circled the wagons, and lives in a multi-layered life behind layered walls of security, disinformation, and distrust. 2 years ago, I gave a talk at DEF CON 9 that was, in my opinion, it was the high point for Simple Nomad 1.0. I received a lot of positive feedback from this talk, mainly along the lines of agreement that society is heading for a suppressive human rights hell in a handbasket cleverly disguised with a transnational conglomerate cloaking device. It was a call to arms that things were going from bad to worse. After DEF CON 9, September 11th happened, and all of my exaggerated claims, as well as the claims of many others, began to happen. Claims of the coming neo-Hooverism began to usher forth, starting with the passage of USA Patriot, and followed by a series of presidential directives and legislation currently in various stages, some passed into law, some pending before a willing Congress, that seriously attacks the hacker and hacker culture. What became of that so-called warning, that call to arms? Nothing. Why? Because I trusted my own logic. I assumed that everyone at DEF CON was just like me and react the same way that I did. Rather than assuming the Russ Cooper-esque title of Cassandra of the Internet and blame my audience, or assume that I was simply an old schooler talking to a jaded generation beyond my reach, I try to think things through. Hopefully I've learned a thing or two about trust and a bit about control. So this brings us, quite naturally, as Richard Thieme would say, to aliens and UFOs. I mean, just give me a minute to explain here. How many people here have seen or know someone who has seen a UFO? Okay, now think about it. Know someone who has seen a UFO. Again, come on now, think about it. Do you know someone that says they've seen a UFO? There's probably quite a few when you think about it. I actually find this to be fairly compelling. For years, we have been taught that to utter a belief in UFOs, admit seeing a UFO, or confessing a belief that aliens are trading antimatter reactors to our government for porn, is to stand up and say that we are crazy. The media has very effectively taught us this. This is a control. However, it's human nature to talk about the weird and bizarre, so eventually a fringe element proclaims whatever truths they can find. They're easily led astray with disinformation, but they manage to make enough noise to get at least parts of society to acknowledge some of their truths. Their truths almost become a religion, and now, after several years, it is okay to acknowledge in public, as a number of you did by raising your hands, or at least among friends, to admit that you or someone you know and trust has seen a UFO. With careful encouragement from the media, it has become okay. It is even a relief to acknowledge this because you aren't crazy. In fact, you are normal. What is interesting is that the government can keep up its denial of UFOs. We can keep confessing to each other and get a warm fuzzy because the nature of humans is to want to be accepted above all else. The truth that is out there is going to remain just that, out there, not here. We think we are one up on the government when in fact we are not. Instead of continuing to fight the good fight, we are actually becoming more docile. That is a meta-control. Remember, we live in a world where the slime marketeers understand that everyone thinks they are one of those 10%ers. I think you know what I'm talking about. You know, only the cool people buy our stuff. It's not for everyone. Yet everybody buys the product. Simple math says everyone cannot be in the 10%. But if you create the illusion, then maybe they'll go ahead and buy your shit sandwiches that you're selling or whatever. Are we also amazing that all of us are among the 10% best athletes, best drivers, best lovers, best hackers? At DEF CON 9, I spoke from perceived vantage point that I was among the fringe element, and I assumed that I and the audience were within that 10%. Instead, I encountered a meta-control. In spite of the fact that right after 9/11, we all knew shit like USA Patriot was on the way, there apparently was nothing we could really do about it, or if there was, we were content to get that warm fuzzy by simply sharing our concerns with each other. The call to arms was nothing but a warm fuzzy. It has taken me 2 years to understand that I hit a meta-control, that I was not in the 10%. In fact, the existence of the 10% was probably illusion to begin with anyway. But it was the understanding of a truth, the realization that a new millennium hacker was emerging from within my limited 1.0 view of the world. I watched myself morph, adapt, and change to my world. I literally watched myself circle the digital wagons. And in doing so, I watched the air gap between NIM and psyche, between the virtual world and the physical world, disappear. To understand the truth about something like a computer is to not only understand how the components fit together, how they interact, when they can be bent or broken, when you can exploit sublevels of trust between components to bypass control, is also to understand the computer's placement within a network of others. Understanding that the computer, whether placed in the home or in the office, is a reflection of the user that stores their data on it. Understanding that the data itself, when coupled with other computers on the network near it, tell such interesting stories, like who controls the company, who hides the company's secrets, or who controls the cash flow. Hacking business processes, hacking corporate culture, controlling the flotsam and jetsam in the digital flow. And hacking becomes meta-hacking. Imagine tying companies together within the same industry at this level. And then other industries, then governments, and even nation states. Is that too big? No. We cannot think in those terms anymore. Like it or not, hacking has changed. We have to think big. Hacking is not just about seeing the limits of a computer system or even the limits of the political world that has risen up around the modern-day hacker. Hacking is about understanding the system, the complete system. You must hack yourself. not the digital self, because there truly is no division anymore. We are plugged in, and there ain't no going back. We have to hack ourselves. Not just surface tension that is wrapped in a NIM, but the core of your hacker self. Explore mental ring zero. Live to hack and hack to live. This is the future of meta-hacking. Not just controlling the operating system, but controlling and influencing what the operators of that system do. Whether those operators do what they do for good or ill, or whether that system is a computer, a political set of ideals, or your own thought processes. This is why we are pursued through cyberspace by USA Patriot and other horses of the digital apocalypse. It is our potential. If we turned our hacking skills from the systems that we have root on to the data stored on those systems and what that data represents, we could possibly discover where that 10% is really at. I'm not going to tell anyone what to do anymore, namely because until I fully understand and truly understand my own truths and can trust my vision and my understanding of the controls that bind me, I only serve the will of others. Others who wish to control you and me, that's who that other is. I cannot tell you where the truth lies because I refuse to accept the reality shoveled up my ass by the man. I have to question everything, and while I'm not telling you what to do, I am inviting you to do the same. Question yourself. Question your questions, and most of all, question your lack of a question. Martin Luther King Jr. said he dreamt of a day when a man was judged not by the color of his skin, but by the content of his character. I dream of a day when a hacker is judged not by the color of his hat, but by the content of his code. I'd like to close with my colleagues J. Random's infamous paraphrasing from Fight Club on IRC one night. The people you are after are the people you depend on. We develop your apps, we back up your data, we route your packets, we defend you while you sleep. Do not fuck with us. I thank you, NMRC thanks you, and we look forward to seeing you again next year. Thank you very much.
If anyone wants any NMRC OSCEs.